You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another fantastic episode of Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings, bringing you another very informative show today as we enter the holiday season. So, with that, Susan, what's today's topic going
to
be?
Well, we have, you know, we try to, kind of review things we've talked about, but we also like to find new topics. And we have not talked about the financial responsibility program, which is just, you know, ever so popular. But it is an important program for a lot of different entities. And of course, it is also under the First Step Act. It is an official productive activity. So being compliant with the financial responsibility program is important for those time credits. So thought this would be a good opportunity to talk about the national policy. And for our viewers at home that are taking notes, that is program statement 5380.08. If you are looking that up on the BOP website, you will notice it is dated 2005. So it predates the Second Chance Act. And when we get to the section when we talk about penalties, if you're taking notes, you'll want to pay attention, because the Second Chance Act actually changed some of the things in terms of the financial responsibility program, in terms of the impact of noncompliance. But so before we start talking about the payment plan itself, I thought it'd be a good place just to jump in and talk about the types of obligations that the courts can order that the Bureau is permitted to collect through the financial responsibility program. And then some of the issues associated with them. So without further ado, obviously, everyone is familiar with everybody. Even if you don't get fines, you don't get restitution, you get a special assessment. And currently that, I believe, is $100 per offense count on your judgment. And it is a flat fee. Those funds are actually collected by the U.S. Attorney and go to the National Crime Victims Fund. So that fund funds programming for victims of crime. But that is collected. That's usually the first one the Bureau collects in terms of kind of order of operandi. And it's ordinarily, the Bureau is looking to collect those. Your case manager is going to talk to you about, you know, a single payment or two payments, something to get it out of the way quickly, because it generally is smaller. A lot of folks are only coming in with one or two, maybe three counts. Rarely do you see someone with a whole stack of counts where those numbers start to climb. For those in pre-trial, or I should say pre-arrival status, getting that taken care of, really good decision. Have a copy of the receipt in hand. According to the policy, the Bureau is not supposed to accept copies. They want to see the original. And depending on your case management, it may or may not be the case. But if you're turning in, you're bringing an original copy of the original receipt with you when you voluntary surrender, or you're having your family mail it in, always, always, always keep copies at home. Don't give up your only copy. So that's real important. But like I said, that's usually a nominal, and people get out of the way quickly. For individuals, perhaps with larger ones, or if there are reasons it's not collected initially, that obligation ceases to exist after 5 years. So after 5 years, if you're someone who got a whole bunch of charges, and you've got $1,200, $1,300, $1,500 worth of special assessment fees, and you're paying those on a quarterly basis, when you hit that five-year mark, they're no longer collected. in most cases, like I said, that's the first one to be collected. The next one to be collected is restitution. So restitution is money paid to victims, whether that victim is an individual person, whether it is a business, or whether it's to a government entity. You know, in fraud cases, we see restitution being owed to Medicare, Medicaid, those kind of things. So an organization, the government, or a person. There are situations where restitution will actually take priority over payment of the special assessment. Very small things. Usually it's an individual. It's not a business. Usually it's a victim of violent crime. And then in some cases, the U.S. Attorney's Office will actually request that the victims be paid first. But for the most part, special assessment and then the victims. Now, something we see in restitution, and we've had conversations with our clients about this, is this notion of jointly and severally owed. I find it's kind of annoying for a lot of folks to deal with. You'll see this in cases where there's two or three defendants, co-defendants in a case that have all been ordered restitution. They were all part of a fraud case. That's usually where you see this. And jointly and severally owed means everyone owes the entire amount until it's paid off. So if you are both jointly and severally responsible for a restitution payment and your two co-defendants are not ponying up money, or they're only paying $25 a quarter and you've made larger payments, it's not like they're going to divide by three. And when you hit your one third, you're off the hook.
Right.
Every person is on the hook until the entire amount is paid. And I know that can create some challenges. I mean, we've talked to clients that create some challenges, especially because usually they're large restitutions. It can be quite problematic.
Do you have any suggestions about, you know, some people just make the minimum payment while they're in BOP custody and then deal with that issue?
Well, we're going to talk about payments, but yep. Individuals don't get to choose if they only make a minimal payment. Now, there are some exceptions, but the payment plan that the unit team is going to ascribe to a person is based on a formula. It's based on how much money is coming into their account. So you can't just say, well, I'm just going to pay that $25 a quarter and not deal with it. You just don't get to do that. And like I said, there are some exceptions. And when we get to that, we'll dig into that because the formula is important. Funny story. I will divert for a minute. Bruce and I, many, many years ago, worked at the same facility, and FRP became kind of contentious in one of the unit teams that he and I were on together. He was attending as the psychology department rep, and it was so contentious that I used to meet with my folks ahead of time and say, okay, so this is what we're going to do. And I would have them voluntarily agree to increase to an amount that maybe wasn't, this was before the formula days. This was pre-formula. This was back when folks could waive their team and didn't have to appear in person.
Right.
And we would have a conversation about, well, this is how much money you got in. And I can tell you, if you're in person and team, it's going to get raised. But let's do this. Let's you agree to this kind of interim amount for the next 6 months, and then we'll see what your commissary account looks like. Because if I know you remember a few pretty hairy meetings over FRP.
Right.
And like I said, this was a long time ago. This was pre-2005, where we didn't have the formula. And so figuring out what somebody was going to pay was all
just
over
pick a number. Place. Yeah.
Yeah. It was just kind of like pick a number. And so I used to kind of try to keep the peace, so to speak. But it
was.
Well,
was there a fight? Tell me the rest of the story.
You were just, there, like
I was there, but what happened?
Yeah. Well, there was a contentious discussion regarding how much FRP was going to be paid, and I had had the conversation with the individual before coming into team, and she didn't like my idea, and in the end, she ended up paying more money because the unit manager was more stringent about that at the time. And I thought a little too stringent, my opinion. So I had suggested waiving the team, increase it to this amount, come back in 6 months and see how your commissary account looks. And she didn't want to do that. So
yeah,
we were in team, and then she was arguing with the unit manager, and I was trying to negotiate a piece, and it didn't go well. It was a bad day. Anyway,
yeah, I guess.
When it comes to restitution, and I am going to read this so that I don't screw this up, for individuals that are prosecuted after April 24th, 1996, Prison Litigation Reform Act, PLRA, restitution ceases to be obligated 20 years after releasing from incarceration. So it goes well beyond SRT. If a person comes back into prison, so whether you violate supervised release and come back into prison, or you come back on a completely new conviction, say 5, 6, 7 years later, that restitution is still owed. The Bureau doesn't need a new order saying it's still owed. By law, that restitution remains in effect. That restitution order remains in effect for 20 years after the end of incarceration. For folks prosecuted before April of 96, it is circuit by circuit. So again, if somebody's coming back into prison, they very well may be looking at not only paying on their new financial obligations, but paying on those old financial obligations. And again, if you're coming back into prison and you have been paying, you're going to want to have that documentation to show what was paid in the interim, because the Bureau is going to have information about what was collected in custody. They will not have information about what an individual paid during their period of supervised release. Sometimes if someone's coming back in as an SRT violator, sometimes that information will be included. Other times it's not. So, you know, for your own benefit, you know, if you've made payments, you need to be bringing that documentation with you. Fines and court costs. Again, these are penalties where restitution is compensation to a victim. Fines are merely penalties. And again, these cease to, for PLRA cases, so convicted after April 96, fines are only collected for 20 years after the judgment is imposed, where restitution is 20 years after incarceration ends. This is with the judgment. Additionally, fines are discharged upon death. So for individuals who still owe money to the government and they pass away, those fines are then discharged. So their estate, their family isn't having to pay those funds. Another area little known is the Bureau can collect state and local obligations, child support payments, alimony payments. Yeah. Now, they do have to have a copy of the order, right? They can't just, you know, your PSR says, you know, your in arrears $1,200 on child support, or, you know, or you have this child support payment. They do have to get a copy of the order. But again, once assessments, fines, and restitutions are taken care of, they can deal with that. And then the last area is just other federal obligations. These could be VA claims. It could be student loan payments, tax liabilities. freedom of information, public information. You know, if you request under freedom of information for documents, you may be charged for those documents. Those are the kind of other obligations that can come up. Make sense?
Yep.
Okay. So now let's talk about how that payment plan is set up.
Yes, so the payment plan.
So what happens is someone, you come into your initial team, you show up at the door. The first thing the Bureau is doing is they're looking at the judgment and commitment order. Now let's assume you don't walk in the door with receipts in tow. They are going to set up a payment plan based on what's there. $100 special assessment fee, $15,000 fine, whatever the case is. They're going to set up a payment plan. Now, because this is being done at your initial team, realistically, you probably haven't gotten a lot sent in, but they are still going to look at that commissary balance. They may just, as an initial, set you up at a $25 payment. If you only owe a special assessment fee, they're going to talk to you about either making a single payment or maybe splitting it in two, $50 this month, $50 next month. If you're walking in and you have zero resources, right, your unit team may decide to put you in what's called temporary exempt status for 6 months, allow you to accumulate funds in your account before starting the FRP payment program. And that is permissible. Depending on the situation, they could extend that longer, but it is reviewed every 6 months if they're going to extend it. I will tell you, just having money through the inmate pay program is not grounds to be on temp exempt. Not having any outside resources, you'd be limited to the $25 a quarter. That's kind of that base amount.
Right.
But just for individuals who aren't getting outside resources in, there still will be an expectation of payment. So people need to be thinking about that. And that's why this exempt status, to allow them to wait 6 months, work, accumulate some funds, pick up some things in commissary that they need, and then start making payments.
Okay.
Every 6 months, or I should say every time you come to team, they're going to look at this again. They're going to go through and they're going to look at commissary balance. And this is kind of a challenging point for folks, is their family is sending them money in so that they can buy commissary or they can do whatever it is they want to do. But from the Bureau's position, any money in the commissary account is in the commissary account, mm-hmm, and it can be subject to payment. It is now yours. It doesn't matter whether it came from employment, whether it came from the outside. It's a non-issue. So back, one of the changes prior to 2005, there was no consideration for phones. For those interested in like really old history, there was a case called Washington v. Reno, individual, female, in custody, brought a habeas action against the Bureau regarding FRP and the phones. And there was kind of a, for lack of a better word, a negotiated settlement on the case. And now individuals are required to do, if they have a required obligation, they pay $25 a quarter minimum. In order to assess someone, go ahead.
Was that because of the lawsuit?
Yes, the $25 a minimum was always there. Oh, but okay. The Bureau didn't take into account phone calls, using the phone system and things like that prior to this case.
Okay.
So as part of the settlement was, the Bureau said, okay, we're going to, if we're going to collect more than $25 a quarter, we are going to take off funds. We're going to allow you to allocate funds for the phone system. So that amount is $75 a month or $450 over a 6 month period. So going back to that commissary account balance, right? They're going to take that total commissary account balance. They're going to subtract $450 right off the top of it. Then they're going to subtract off the payments that were made during that period of time. The remaining balance is considered discretionary funds. And if you read the policy, there is nothing that says anything in terms of a percentage of that. Unit team can come back and say, okay, we allowed for 450, we allowed your payments off. You still have $300 in your account. That averages $50 a month. We're going to increase you to $50 a month on your payment plan. Most don't go that far. Again, kind of flashing back to my case management coordinator days, it was not uncommon for one of the guys to come and complain at Mainline about how much money their case manager was wanting them to pay in FRP. And my experience was most of the case managers weren't, I would have collected more. They really were going easy on them. So I used to warn people, okay, if you want me to review your commissary account, that's fine.
So what,
but if
what
I group, decide your payment should be higher, you're going to have to agree to it.
How would you, by what theory or rubric would you use to, let's just bump it up a little bit. Yeah, is it a certain, a flat tax?
There's nothing in policy. There's no flat tax. There's no percent.
I know, I'm just asking
As a rule of thumb, I looked at 50% of your discretionary income. So I subtracted the 450, I subtracted the amount of money came out, and if you had $300 left, that's averages $50 a month. If you weren't making at least a $25 monthly payment, I was going to increase you. So I looked at 50% of the discretionary. But like I said, there's nothing in policy that says 50%, 25%, 100%. And I know they were looking at that. There is some new proposed rules language that they're looking at for FRP that has not come to fruition yet.
So when you were CMC at a particular institution, you might have different case managers looking at this differently and assessing FRP.
Oh yeah. Because some of the case managers would go hard. And some of the case managers were like, yeah, just pay your, if you pay it, I won't bug you. Like, don't bounce your payment. If you bounce your payment, I'm going to bump you up,
So then people would
come and complain to me,
I would just the way things are, shouldn't there been some sort of uniformity in terms of, I like what you're saying.
Here's what they looked at is, they wanted the unit teams to still take in those individual issues. Okay, you have discretionary money,
but
you're not spending it in the commissary. You're sending it home to provide for your children or for an elderly parent, or maybe you're working on some legal stuff and you're making, you're paying for copies and mailing. So the idea was not to have a fixed amount, but to, in fact, consider that discretion in the case to case. Now, one of the things that's going on, and it was kind of funny, there's a backstory to it, but so the Bureau is looking at, they haven't got there yet, but moving toward a more automated FRP system where it's kind of like 10% across the board, this is what comes out, and, kind of like first fruits, tithing, 10%, it's tithing, right? And it would be across the board, a flat tax, so to speak, right?
Yep.
So when it was first brought up as an idea, and this was in the previous administration, coming from the Bureau, it was going to be 10%, right? So now anyone who's familiar with the proposed language that actually got published, it was 75%. So, and of course, people just absolutely lost it.
Lost it.
And, you know, a lot of times when it comes to published rules language, they may get 100 comments, 200 comments. They got well over 1,000 comments.
Oh, I bet.
They Maine Justice, right? And the funny part was, it was Maine Justice who were, you know, the Bureau approached it from a flat tax, 10% off the top. It's not going to hurt anyone, even in terms of, one, making sure that obviously there's individual issues, but if you're consistently taking 10% every month, the calculus was, we're going to collect more overall. So we might be collecting less from this one individual inmate, but by doing it across the board, even if someone is only paying $2 or $3 a month toward their obligations, they're still paying something, right? That was the idea. It was actually a very good idea. A number of states have moved to this kind of automated, you walk in the door, they load you into the system, and anything that comes into your account, 10% comes off the top, and the rest of it is available to you. But that wasn't enough for the previous administration. If you recall, the Bureau got some press about folks like Larry Nassar, and the amount of restitution he wasn't paying, as well as some other cases. There was a retired U.S. Marshal that was had an axe to grind, and anyway, it was a hot mess. So again, it's in the news. So the Bureau does this rules language proposal, and the Maine Justice keep like, no, that's not enough. We need to bump it up higher. So then the final result was this 75%, which was just ridiculous.
Right.
And
I remember that. Yep.
Yeah, it was just ridiculous because we still wanted people to be able to call home, to send emails, to buy their commissary, you know? And so then when they got all of these responses, then they came back to the Bureau and was like, oh, help us respond. And it was like, this is your fault. You did this to yourself. Anyway, kind of comical.
Right.
But yeah, so there are changes. There are things they're looking that would be kind of, like I said, a flat fare across the board. Also, from a just a practical administrative standpoint, if you're doing a flat 10% across the board for anybody that owes, then you don't have case managers having to spend the time, or correctional counselors, who's ever doing it,
right,
in the team, pulling that data, figuring
having
it out.
Having to calculate what it is for this person.
Right. Do the calculations, talk about it, make changes, submit the changes so they can be keyed, because this is still done manually. You know, a case, an inmate will get a piece of paper, FRP plan, that they sign. And then either the case manager or correctional counselor is manually entering this information into the PACE system. So every single time they make that change, they're going back in and they're making more changes. And it's just, in this day and age, it is just a complete waste of resources from my perspective. It is so inefficient. So yes, some across the board system would be totally great.
But you're saying we're headed toward an automated deal.
Yes. Okay. And obviously, you know, making a change, for those who may not necessarily be familiar with the structure of policy, bolded language in older policies or blue text in newer policies are CFR rules language, Code of Federal Regulations. Mm-hmm. So when the Bureau wants to make a change like this is, to going to this automated system where it's not going to be a formula that it's just going to be this flat 10% or whatever the final percent is, that requires rules to get changed. Rules language typically take 2 years to get changed. It is a very slow, just
now
crazy
really
process.
Now that there's not a huge union presence, will that quicken things?
Not on the rules language. Like, nothing can be done until the rules language is finalized. The folks in the Correctional Programs Division can be drafting what the new policy would look like and can have it sitting on their desk. But until Maine Justice approves it and finalizes, you know, it goes through that process, a new policy is irrelevant. So then once that gets approved into the rules language, then the policy process can start. And yes, in theory, without a union, that the policy process could go faster. Right. I don't know, because I'm not involved in that anymore, obviously. But I do know policies that I had in draft and ready to start a process haven't gone anywhere in the year and a half that I've been retired. In fact, one of them was actually kind of done in the department and was in the process of moving to the next phase, and it's still on hold. So hopefully, and I think part of that was a function of the change in administration, the change in directors. I think you're going to start seeing, I'm hoping to see in 2026, you start to see, you know, more policy rolling out. So we've talked about that process that we're dealing with now, and it is, you know, it's a math problem. So that's what needs to be done. And like I said, the fact that there is no percent or expectation, there's no formula after you get discretionary income, does make it more challenging for individuals. So, but that is done, like I said, that's done every time a person comes to team. Separate from, now these are folks for not those who are not working in Unicor. Unicor has its own set of rules. Unicor, of course, is Prison Industries, and they have their own pay structure where folks not in Unicor, there's grades 1 through 4. Unicor has a training grade plus grades 1 through 5. They also have the opportunity to earn longevity pay, to earn raises, depending on what kind of factory they're working in. It, for instance, textiles work on piecework, and the amount that you're paid is based on the complexity of what you're sewing. So if you're like brand new and you're sewing 2 pieces together, and you know that's it, just one straight line, your piecework rate is substantially lower than a person who's, you know, fabricating a collar or something that's more complex.
Was that call center at Carswell there when you were there? Remember the call? We had female Unicor.
Was it a call center? I thought it was like a data, like they handled GSA that's vehicle true. Logs or something.
My bad. It was something like that. So how do they calculate the pay when it's not a piecemeal thing? It's just an hourly
rate. And in those cases, and those are examples. Call centers, data entry centers, those are examples where they're going to have a straight hourly wage. But even with their hourly wage, they're eligible for longevity pay. After they've been working continuously in Unicor for a period of time, they get a bump in their pay. Because they've stayed in Unicor and they haven't had trouble, misconduct, and gotten booted out. So they get bonuses for that. For them, once you get past grade one, which is that kind of entry-level walk in the door, and are making more than $50 a month, they are expected to pay 50% of their pay. So
toward FRP.
Toward their FRP. And if they don't want to, then they're not going to be employed. You voluntarily agree to pay
50%. So they know that in the front end when they sign up.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And they're not held to that 50% until they reach the $50 level. So 50% would be $25 a month.
Past grade one, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then, yes. And then if they don't want to, they can leave and go find another job. It's
real
very
quick.
Simple.
Did we have orderlies that made as much as the Unicor folks, or the Unicor folks make the most?
Oh, Unicor folks make the most by and large. I mean, trust fund, those who work for trust fund. Especially later on, you know, trust fund is the warehouse commissary. most institutions have a couple, one or two trust fund folks who are on the unit that help teach the inmates how to, on the housing unit, how to use the TruLink system and all of that.
Facility, trust fund, powerhouse detail, seems pretty.
Those are regular pay. Are regular pay. So there's three pay systems in the Bureau. There's the inmate performance pay, which as a case management coordinator, I was responsible for that budget. There is Unicor, which is non-appropriated funds. Okay. Actually, none of the, that's the interesting
part. So you were the cost center manager for that?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That was my, impressive. I had to figure out the budgets for all the departments.
Wow.
Okay. So inmate performance pay is actually funded from proceeds from commissary sales. So no taxpayer dollars are used in any of the pay programs. But inmate performance pay is the bulk of the folks. That's food service, that's orderlies, facilities, all of those folks. Okay. Education, that kind of thing. Then Unicor covers Unicor, and that's the factory. And also, if Unicor has their own warehouse, then they would have warehouse workers as well. Okay. And then trust fund handles, again, their commissary, not the regular warehouse, their commissary warehouse, as well as the commissary itself, the TruLinks coaches that are on the housing units. And again, their pay is funded through commissary sales. Unicor is funded through Unicor. And so, yeah, they have their different, they're different pots. So, yeah. So
that's awesome. Anyway. Yeah, no, I never, you know, being, I learned all the cost center stuff when I went to the region. Well, that's not true. I ran 317 or something that was a drug, you know, baby
right.
drug cost center. But, okay. Good.
Yeah. I had inmate pay and so that's where, well, and it's changed now with First Step Back, but that's where education got their incentive, their pay money when an individual completed their GED and got a completion bonus, a $25 completion bonus. The drug program with their phase completion bonuses, that came out of the inmate performance pay budget.
Yep.
That
yep.
now comes out of FSA money. That was changed up. So because obviously education, the substance abuse programs, those are all evidence-based EBBRs. And so the incentives from that come from the incentive from the FSA money now. FRP is collected once a month. The departments code in, key in the hours for everybody and the bonuses. And then usually the case management coordinator reviews that all and yells at the people who didn't turn it in on time. And not yells. That's a little bit of an exaggeration. Not much, though. Yells at the departments that didn't turn it in on time. Because like I couldn't process pay until I had all of the departments. So certain departments, I'd be like, Chaplain.
So you're going to department head meetings, raising hell?
Yeah, yeah. Or that they didn't stick to their budget, you know, because they're paying
right.
too many grade ones. And then I get to hear things like, you know, but he's a good worker and he doesn't have his GED, so I wanted to give him more money. And I'm like, how about encourage him to get his GED?
Yeah,
yeah. So, yeah, it was kind of fun.
So the FRP for our viewers, it gets
Absolutely.
Processed by the 10th of each month, you would say?
Mm-hmm.
Ish. Okay.
Right. So what happens is pay is posted, and as soon as pay is posted, so pay is posted by about the 10th of the month, literally as soon as they post the pay, they hit the button for FRP, essentially so that you don't have time to go to commissary in between your pay being posted.
And drain it. Right.
And drain it.
That's awesome.
Speaking of draining things, you know, so in addition to your commissary account, right, you have your inmate phone account. You also now have a release account where you can put release funds and accumulate them. And of course, once you move money to telephone, it can't be pulled back. Once you move it to release funds, it can't be pulled back. that is not a means to avoid making FRP payments. The unit team is not going to say, oh, well, your commissary balance is X because you just moved, you had this bunch of money come in and you moved $500 to your phone account. So now you don't have it anymore. No, you are still responsible for that resource. So trying to, you know, you and I have conversations with folks and we discourage people from trying to manipulate the system. And this is one of those areas where people do. And then they're in a situation where their unit team has said, so sad, so sorry. You did this. You still need to pay this money. And you probably need to not move any money over to your phone account for a while because you just dropped $500 over in there. And if a person goes into refuse status, because the FRP program is a productive activity, you are automatically in opt-out status. And if you are in opt-out status, you are not earning time credits, and the credits that you have, you no longer have access to. So if you go into refuse status, and we've talked about this with just in general in opt-out status, we also talk about it in our book, Unlocking Federal Time Credits. When someone is in opt-out status, that means they're not accumulating programming days. And if you're not accumulating programming days, you can't earn
time, man.
You can't earn the time credits. And it's not like you can go back and change your mind.
Restore.
And get, because there is no restoration of programming days. Once they're gone, they're gone. The calendar has passed. We've moved to another page.
I think the good news is we really haven't seen a lot of, you know, people, hey, I was in out of status, and we haven't run into a lot of FRP.
And I think we don't, right? Because for the last 40 years, maybe longer, I'd have to think about it, but at least probably the last 40 years or longer, the Bureau has been collecting FRP, and everybody knows if you're in FRP refuse status, you got nothing coming. So when time credits rolled around, there was no thought. Like, everybody knew you got nothing coming if you're in refuse status. Pay your darn bill. And that just kind of carried over. So another kind of funny story. Regularly would be involved in meetings with individuals from Maine Justice. And on one occasion, we were talking about FRP and time credits. And an individual said to me, do you mean to tell me that you have people that are otherwise programming but are in refuse status, so they're not getting time credits? And I'm like, oh, 100%. 100%. But the number is actually very small. That ability to earn time credits is a huge motivating factor.
Huge.
The folks that are it's something like, of all of the people that are eligible to get time credits and are actively could be earning them, the number is like, when I did some statistics, it's like less than 4%. And those individuals that are in FRP refuse status, so they're not getting their time credits, they're also declining other programs. They're refusing drug treatment. They have a substance abuse history. They don't want to go to GED either. I mean, they don't want to go to education class.
Are they otherwise FRP ineligible? They're in a penitentiary. Their pattern risk is high. So
yeah, two groups. You have the ones that are ineligible by statute or by risk level. So they're like, don't care.
Screw it.
And then you have the other group, and this is that very tiny group that are otherwise eligible and could be getting credits, but they aren't, but they're also not compliant in other areas. FRP isn't the only thing that they're not compliant in. Now and I'll just put this out there. I know we're getting close to the end today, is for individuals who are in medium or high risk, if you are not statutorily restricted from time credits, you don't got a 924C, you don't got a fentanyl case, you know, you are earning credits. You are just not able to apply your credits. For God's sakes, pay your FRP, because when your risk level changes, or you go to the warden for an exception, and I know we talked about exceptions a while ago. We're going to need to talk about those again in the new year. You know, if you've been paying your FRP all along and you've been compliant with all these areas, and the warden signs off on you getting an exception or your points drop to low, all of those time credits drop into your record immediately. And if you're in FRP refuse status, there is no going back and getting them. You've lost. Those are off the table. So,
right.
And I get for those who are ineligible to earn credits, you know, they're in a position to say, well, I ain't got nothing coming. What am I worried about? But we know people have been talking about modifications to the law. People are looking at additional changes to FSA. Whether that happens or not, you know, obviously you don't want to be in a position where it changes and you miss the boat.
Right.
But anyway.
Absolutely. You can come back to haunt you if you're not.
I'm going
to
say one last thing on noncompliance, and this is a change that's because of the Second Chance Act. If you're looking at the policy, it says if you're in FRP refuse status, you do not get pre-release placement. That changed when the Second Chance came out. And the five-factor review that obviously we've talked about on several shows. But that is an example of one of the things that has changed as a course of the Second Chance Act. Now, things like custody classification, getting 0 points on adjustment, that's still in place. Non-preferred housing, although we don't have a lot of preferred housing in the agency, but that's still there. But FRP refuse status is also a pattern issue. So if you are minimum or low, or maybe you're not low, but you're medium, going into refuse status is going to mess up your points. So it will bump you up. It's about noncompliance, and that's what the recidivism risk tool is about, is noncompliance. That's what recidivism is. You came back.
Yeah.
So anyway,
I'm glad you brought up all these points, because you know sometimes FRP, it's an integral part of your prison experience. It's an integral part of your ability to earn First Step Act credits.
Absolutely.
Get out of prison earlier. So this is something that really isn't addressed. For many people, it just seems like a given, but nothing is a given.
That's
in
right.
The Federal Bureau of Prisons, nothing. So, you know, it's good that we had a nice, mindful coverage of FRP today. Awesome. And again, folks, you know, you're hearing this. If you have questions about it, feel free to reach out. I could do two things at one time. Feel free to reach out on our Facebook group. Ask us some questions there. We fielded some questions this morning on the phone that came through on the page. Our YouTube channel. We got some more subscribers here recently on the YouTube channel. Thank you very much. And so we'll answer the questions. And so I know, and we appreciate everybody's patience, because this stuff is hard to explain. And I mean, so many of the callers, the last, what, 4 out of 5, you know, these ladies were like, look, I don't understand this. This is like another language to me. My loved one is saying this. What is, you know,
absolutely.
Like, well, here's what the policy says.
Nobody should feel bad when they don't understand it, because it is complex. No. It was written badly. So again, the videos, the Facebook group, our books, all are designed to educate.
Yep. So with that, we'll close out today's show. I believe we're going to have a show next week. We may have a special guest, former chief psychologist from an institution in the South Central region might be with us. So that'll be kind of fun. Talk about some things there. Kind of get off the policy path and talk about some psychological stuff, personality disorders and such as that. So that'll be a nice departure for the holidays, but I think we'll keep on going. But we may take a week off. Who knows? We'll figure it out, and you'll know when you see it. So, with that,
all right,
everybody have a safe holiday. If you don't, check in with us, and thanks for being there. Listen to us on Amazon, Audible, on Apple Podcast, of course, LA Talk Radio. All of our shows are archived there. Thank you very much, Sam, and everybody at the staff here at LA Talk Radio. So with that, have a great holiday if we don't see you. Otherwise, we'll see you next week. Take care, everybody. See you.
Bye.
Be safe.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.